Welcome, friends. This is James Corbett of CorbettReport.com. It is the 10th of May, 2013, here across the Dateline in Japan. It's still the 9th in the United States, where I'm joined on the line today by our friend Bill Conroy of Narconews.com, who's been on this program a few times now in the past, so you should be familiar with him. And if not, you can always check in the Corbett Report archives for Bill Conroy's previous appearances. And you can also, of course, check out Narconews.com for his investigative reporting. So once again, thank you for joining us on the program, Bill. It's great to have you here.
Yeah, glad to be here.
All right, well, today I wanted to talk about a case that is now almost a decade old, but still a fascinating and horrific case in many different aspects. It's been dubbed the House of Death case, and this is a colorful moniker for what was a grisly site of the disposal of several bodies in Juarez, Mexico, related to drug gang activities and also related to an ICE, that's Immigration and Customs Enforcement, undercover operative, informant who was working within that gang and actually participating in the murders there. Just a fascinating story and lots of details to go over in this. So why don't you start by just giving us a background on the House of Death itself and what drug gang was related to it?
Yeah, okay. Well, one of the things that's still relevant with this story is it was the first time that it was proven on the record, actually, through court records, testimony that Mexican law enforcement is the drug cartel in the case of Juarez, and they were actually participating in these murders. And the short of it, in a few graphs, which is hard to do, but between August of 2003 and January of 2004, there were about a dozen people tortured and murdered and buried at this house in Juarez, which has since been dubbed the House of Death. Now, there are many of these houses in Juarez. This was going on all the time. So what was unique about this case is we knew about it, not that it was happening. And the other unique factor in the case was that the murders were being carried out by the Vicente Carrillo Fuentes organization, a cell of that organization. These aren't like giant monoliths. They're basically cells that work together to move drugs across the border and carry out enforcement actions. So this particular cell was run by a top lieutenant in the Juarez drug organization. And one of his chiefs was this individual named Lau, who was in fact also an informant for the U.S. government, for ICE, and actually for DEA and FBI. But when this case was going on, he was working for ICE and for a while for DEA. So basically he had a double role. He was involved with the House of Death murders, helping to plan them, carrying them out and disposing of the bodies. That was actually his job, is to run the House of Death, open it up and get the lime and the tape that was used to murder these people. And then after the murders were done, you know, take them out in the backyard with a grave digger and bury the bodies and pay the grave digger and make sure that word got back to the top guy, whose name was Santillan, that all this was taken care of. So he's doing that. At the same time, he's an informant for, the U.S. government, for Immigration and Customs Enforcement. ICE was his primary role. And like I said, for a short while for DEA. But DEA deactivated him because while he was also participating or helping carry out these murders, he was also still running drugs. So he got caught with running a load of dope, marijuana, across the Mexico border early in this process, and DEA deactivated him. So we won't deal with him anymore. But ICE decided they wanted to keep doing it, got special permission from Washington to continue operating him as an informant. The other part of this case is his U.S. government handlers, that is ICE supervisors, including the U.S. attorney in Texas at the time, knew he had participated in these murders and authorized his continued essential part, participation, because they wanted to make, a case or get more information on the Juarez cartel. And so that's kind of the double twist in it. We had a U.S. government informant participating and helping to plan murders, essentially with the approval of U.S. law enforcement officials. At the same time, this guy was a rising star in the Juarez drug organization and had quite a bit of control and power there. And ultimately, his fate is kind of interesting, and you probably want to talk about that. But also, there's another component to the story in that one of the DEA supervisors who was aware of this, and I can tell you how he became aware, ended up blowing the whistle on the U.S. government's complicity via this informant in these murders in Mexico. And that guy's name was Sandalio Gonzalez. He was the head of DEA in El Paso, the El Paso field office. So I'll leave it there. I can walk you through the actual story of Sandy. That'll give you a little more insight into how all these pieces fit together when you're ready for that.
Right. I think that's important to do, because my understanding of the story is not just that this informant was participating in the murders, and not just that his handlers were aware of this, but in fact that in many cases they were aware even before he did participate in the murders that he was going to participate in them. At least that's my understanding of that.
That's absolutely right. He was tape recording many of these murders initially, and they actually told him to stop because they didn't want evidence of it. And because he was operating this house for the cell, this drug organization cell, they would call him up, and they would call these carne asadas anytime they wanted to kill or murder or torture or bury someone at the house. The code word on the phone was carne asada. So they'd call up Lau and say, open up the house. We're going to have a carne asada. So at that point, he knew that there was going to be a body dump or murder or somebody tortured there. Since Lau's phone was monitored by the U.S. government because he was their informant, they knew in real time when these things were going to be taking place, and they didn't lift a finger to stop it.
It's an absolutely incredible story. So let's get into the Sandalio Gonzalez whistleblowing story and how he came to find out about all of this.
Well, this whole trail of events started in August 2003 with the first murder that the informant participated in. He tape recorded it, and he went back to El Paso and reported it to his ICE handlers. So they had it all. They knew at that point he had participated in a murder. What ICE told the Mexican government is that he witnessed a murder. And ICE also didn't give enough information to DEA, because DEA at that point wanted to shut the case down and arrest Santillan. They had enough evidence to arrest the top guy in this drug cell right after the first murder, for sure, actually before that. But when that first murder happened, DEA wanted to shut everything down and wrap it up, but ICE didn't. ICE wanted to keep it going. And again, they went through all their people in Washington, and the U.S. attorney at the time, Johnny Sutton, would have been the guy to sign off on this, and his bosses above him, they kept the case going, resulting in at least, 11 more murders. But the culmination of this then was in January of 2004, some 5 months after that first murder. Three guys were brought to the house and were tortured, and one of them gave up an address. The people do it. There's various stories as to why these three individuals were brought there to be tortured. I won't go into all those details, but one thing is certain: they were tortured and killed. And before they died, one of them gave up an address, and that address happened to be to the home of a DEA agent in Juarez. And these guys wouldn't have been operating in the open. I mean, this wouldn't have been common knowledge. So one of the suspicions is that one of these guys killed either was an informant or had some connection to DEA to have this information. So at any rate, the Santillan, who's the head of this VCF cell, once he got this information, sent some of his people over to that house, to that address, allegedly thinking that this was a crooked cop, there was dope there, various stories. They knocked on the door. The DEA agent wasn't home. His wife and kids were. They knew enough not to answer the door. They called her, she called her husband. Her husband came home, picked him up, and got in the car, and they were making a beeline out of Juarez because they knew this was trouble. But before they got too far, Santillan's men had tailed him, and they pulled him over. And it was actually the Juarez police, along with some of Santillan's men, kind of indistinguishable, because the police in Juarez, again, this case establishes for the first time on the record, were running drugs. They were involved in assassinations. I mean, they basically were the drug organization. And so they pulled over this DEA agent with his family in the car, not knowing for sure who he was or thinking he was a crooked agent, but it was likely they were going to take this guy back to the house, and his family could very well have ended up dead, like the other people that crossed paths with this organization. The DEA agent made a call. He was smart enough not to get out of the car. Another agent came from the embassy and or the consulate. And the long short of it is they managed to delay things long enough that the thugs let him go. But mind you, while this was going on, while they had pulled over this DEA agent with his wife and kids sitting in the car, Santillan and his chief guy, who was named Miguel Loya, who was the head of the – he was a state – cop, you know, the night shift supervisor for the state cops in Juarez, was on the phone talking to the informant and getting information on who these people were. At the same time, that informant was talking to his ICE handlers, saying, hey, we got a situation here. So all of this came to a head at that point. And so the DEA agent and his family, you know, managed to get out of that sticky situation. Shortly after that, because this had all kind of hit the fan, DEA and ICE now couldn't hide the fact that they had this informant working in this case involved in murders that all came out. They were worried that the Juarez organization was going to go and target all the DEA agents in Juarez. So that night, they pulled everyone out of Juarez. So they basically had a caravan of all the DEA operatives and agents and their families, and moved him out of Juarez into El Paso. That's when, you know, it all became semi-public. Needless to say, the public didn't know, but the agencies knew. And they determined that they were going to launch an investigation to, you know, see what really happened. And it was really another word for a whitewash cover-up, because nothing was going to happen. This was going to get buried. Sandy Gonzalez, who was the, you know, supervisor, the head guy in DA in El Paso, it's one of these guys that, you know, cared about his people and was very, you know, very concerned about what happened, and frankly very ticked off at ICE for what they had done and allowing this informant to run wild like this, to the point where it endangered the lives of his agents and their families in Juarez. So, you know, in February he wrote a letter to his internal memo to his counterpart at ICE in El Paso. And that memo basically just outlined everything, talked about the murders and needless murders in Mexico that this informant was part of, and how, you know, ICE had just completely mishandled this case and put in danger the lives of these DEA agents. That memo made its way to the U.S. attorney, Johnny Sutton. At that point, it went all the way up the chain basically the tops of both the Department of Justice and the Department of Homeland Security. The initial reaction from the then head of DEA, Karen Tandy, was after talking to Johnny Sutton, they agreed that they would silence Gonzalez, ordered him to shut up. He could not talk to the press, ultimately resulting in retaliation against him by essentially, you know, giving him a bad review and putting a lot of heat on him to, you know, shut him down. And, you know, like I said, no comment to the press cover-up. And they wanted to handle it all internally, and, you know, they completed their internal investigation. That has remained buried to this day. Sandy ended up, you know, retiring early from DEA and filing a lawsuit for discrimination based in large part on this incident, and won, evidence that he was in the right. And, you know, the informant after this, if this couldn't get more complicated or sorted, there was another incident that kind of did him in. Is after all this had happened and all the DEA agents had been evacuated, this guy, the informant, was like put underground because they needed him to testify in trial. They ultimately did arrest Santillan. They lured him into El Paso and arrested him. And the informant would be a key witness. Needless to say, this case was not going to go public. There was never going to be a trial. And they did ultimately settle out of court. But at least under the pretense they had to protect the informant, they hit him out in San Antonio where he was doing mall security, believe it or not, working in a mall here as a security guard. But he managed to slip his protection, if you will, and head up to El Paso in the middle of all this for some kind of money drop. He claimed it was part of an ICE sting, that he was helping him out to sting a crooked customs inspector. Various people in ICE say, no, he was just up there to get some money at a house in Juarez that he had sold, and he was trying to get the money from that. Well, while this was all going to happen at a Whataburger, the informant is supposed to go to the Whataburger to pick this money up from this guy. And he instead sends a friend of his, who was like a 26-year-old family guy, and actually was an FBI informant. So he sends his friend to the Whataburger to pick up the money, and the friend gets, you know, plugged with four bullets by some assailant, murdered right in the Whataburger parking lot. Obviously, the bullets were intended for the informant. After that happened, they deep-sixed the informant. They put him in a high-security prison setting and moved him around the country. He was in Minnesota for a while. He ended up in Buffalo. He was in there for years they were trying to deport him. And he argued that if I was deported, he would be killed. Certainly he would have been, because they knew he was an informant. He certainly would have been killed. So he filed for protection under the Geneva Convention against torture. Essentially, you can't send someone back to a country if you know they will be murdered with the participation of the government. And ultimately, he did win deferral under that convention and was released from prison. And to this day is in hiding somewhere in the country in somebody's neighborhood, maybe yours, waiting for the next shoe to drop. That's the wrap up of, and there's a lot of little pieces to it along the way. The, you know, Narco News was, because we released this memo that Sandy wrote, we managed to get our hands on it and published it. And shortly after that, ICE agents showed up at my house and at my workplace, you know, trying to shake me down for my sources. And unsuccessfully.
Well, I want to get into that story in some detail in a minute, but before we do, I understand for your original reporting for this, you did interview Sandy Gonzalez for this story, and you were talking to him about what happened. What was your take on his impression of how he was treated and how this this case progressed? Was he surprised by what happened with his whistleblowing?
I dealt with Sandy over a number of, because I followed this case for, you know, half a decade. So I've talked to him many, many times, and I think there was probably a progression. I think, you know, initially when you're involved in a case like this, you're hopeful that coming forward and you know, it will result in some kind of action from Congress, or, you know, somebody will actually try to make justice work. But you see, as the pieces come together, how every little hope is dashed. You know, so I think you go from optimism to just gutter cynicism about the whole system. Now, you have to talk to him about where he's at now, but clearly there was a lot of disappointment and very little justice, you know, as a result of any of his whistleblowing, other than the fact that people now pretty much know about the case. But the long and short of it is the same thing is going to happen again, you know, and there will be, you know, there's no incentive for it not to happen, because nothing happened to anybody. Nobody, in fact, the people involved in this House of Death case, many of them were promoted. So that's, I mean, and actually another story I'm working on, the latest is one of the people that was involved in this cover-up at the time, James Comey. He was the deputy attorney general, now being talked about, you know, for possible head of the FBI. And he's on the board of one of these major banks. They just got convicted for, they didn't get convicted. They were accused of laundering billions of dollars for the drug cartels, and they got a deferred prosecution agreement. And part of that is they had to hire somebody to help them find their ethics. Well, Comey was hired in that role on the board to help them direct their ethics. This is the same guy that helped cover up the House of Death. He's on all the email trails. So you can see that really it's pretty thick in terms of the people in most cases, and even in the case where they visited me, the people in charge of investigating this are the very people being accused of the problem. in most cases.
Yeah, that's it's funny how that works, and it seems to work that way in a lot of different cases. And again, just before we move on, let's talk a little bit more in depth about the role of U.S. Attorney Johnny Sutton and also the Assistant U.S. Attorney Juanita Fielden in this case. I understand there's a wrongful death suit that was brought against Juanita Fielden related to the House of Death.
Yeah, and against some of the agents. Now, it's complicated with federal law because they can't sue the government because the government has immunity, so they have to bring, it's called a Bivens suit. It's a civil suit against the individuals, and they got to prove that these individuals violated the constitutional rights of the people bringing the lawsuit. In other words, in this case, the families of the murdered victims in Mexico, most of whom were Mexican citizens, brought a civil suit against Juanita Fielden and several of the ICE agents, you know, alleging that they violated the constitutional rights of their loved ones by, you know, contributing to their murders. And that case dragged on for a while, and ultimately the judge ruled that because the murdered people were Mexican citizens, they, you know, really didn't have constitutional rights in the United States, and the suit was thrown out. And in another line of reasoning is, well, they probably would have died anyway, you know, because they're part of the drug war in Mexico.
But there were at least two U.S. deaths, U.S. citizens' deaths in the House of Justice case?
Yeah. The one was a U.S. legal resident, okay, and he was one of the last guys killed at the House of Death on January 14th that led to all this. The other one is actually a separate case that of an individual who was a U.S. citizen who was picked up off the streets in Juarez while with the informant. Later, he disappeared and was murdered. They have not found the body. His body allegedly was buried at the House of Death, or at least a number of sources told me that, but it doesn't show up in any list of bodies. So conveniently, even though everyone knows he's murdered, the body has never been found. So yeah, there is that, but it's hard to bring a case. The Castro family really can't bring a case because there's no body found, no evidence to prove he, you know, even though it's pretty clear he was murdered as a byproduct of the informant's activities.
Well, as with so many stories where a whistleblower steps forward to try to put the stop to practice like this, one of the most disappointing and one of the most frequent letdowns in cases like these are in the realm of the Fourth Estate, the media that lets down the whistleblowers time and again in these types of cases by refusing to go after these stories and refusing to stick up for the journalists who do, like yourself. So let's talk a little bit about the reporting for this story. Obviously, you have been in there in the thick of it since the beginning, but I understand that this story has at least floated around in the mainstream media, but no one has picked up on it, or what it has been the real coverage.
Yeah, I mean, at times it's gotten media coverage, and then it disappears. The real problem is nobody will stick with a story like this and dig into the bigger story. What the media covered was, you know, what we like to call the drug war porn, the violence porn angle of it. They would cover the murders and they'd cover, you know, that aspect of it in the intriguing story of the informant, you know, being in, you know, kind of a double agent. What they wouldn't get into is the power brokers behind it that made it possible for all this to happen. That's where the mainstream media just completely dropped the ball. So, yeah, I mean, major papers picked up the House of Death story after we drummed it in for about 3 years. Initially, the Dallas Morning News reported on the first couple stories of the murders. And frankly, the informant told me those stories. Maybe this sounds unbelievable, but the informant said one of the strategies was to plant when initially the DEA agents were pulled over and it became clear that the whole case was going to blow up, and they knew that Lau was an informant. One of the strategies is to plant stories in the media to get the word out to all the players to split. So the initial coverage of this in Mexico and the Mexican papers and the Dallas Morning News, who knows? I mean, that's kind of spot news. And they, you know, one of the theories is that was actually put out on purpose to help spread the word that, you know, and in fact, one of the major killers, Miguel Loya, the state cop, was able to elude capture in part because he was one step ahead of everybody and knew, you know, right away that he had to, you know, get out of there. And he's still at large to this day. Then there were major papers that picked it up, you know, overseas in Europe and some papers in the States, you know, the Washington Post, the New York Times, I think are the only two that didn't, but it got some AP coverage and so forth. But again, it was like one story and out. NPR did something, one story and out. It was like always focused on this, like, you know, the violence, drug war, porn aspect of it, you know, like, you know, we got to have a good story to get a lot of clicks. Nobody wants to spend 2 or 3 years digging in behind the scenes, figuring out like who caused this to happen, how did the system break down here, and you know, who's responsible. That's the problem. That's where, for whatever reason, and I think it's even worse today, that the you can't really rely on the media to do that. That they got the attention span of a gnat. And at times it seems the intelligence of one as well.
Unfortunately so. But for people who are want to know about the reporting that you've done, the detailed reporting on this, of course, they can go to narconews.com/House of Death, which has the archives of the dozens and dozens and dozens and dozens of stories that you've filed on this over the years. And I want to get into one of the more recent stories, which was the result of a probe into the intimidation that you faced from ICE over your reporting on this story. Perhaps you can set the scene and tell us a little bit about what happened and what type of intimidation you faced after you started breaking this story.
Yeah, well, as I alluded to earlier, after we exposed Sandy Gonzalez's memo, that, you know, that was the first time everyone, you know, it was put out on the internet that essentially this informant was involved in murder, and that, you know, U.S. government knew about it and let him continue to murder people. And so it was pretty embarrassing. And it was, you know, Johnny Sutton, U.S. attorney, whose name was all over this, you know, who also was a friend of the president at the time, was Bush, and had, you know, worked with Bush while Bush was governor of Texas and was kind of a rising political star. This was not good for his political career to have all this out. Well, at any rate, yeah, two ICE agents showed up at my home. I wasn't there. And, you know, they talked to my wife, and I had my kid there, and they, you know, were kind of pressing her to, you know, tell, you know, where is he? And she said, he's at work. You know, she gave him the number. And they left their cards. So I got home and, you know, got on the phone and called them. I said, what do you got? And they never answered. I mean, they never called me back. So the next day, because, you know, I work for Narco News, you know, pro bono. It's a thing I do because it's journalism. And so I have to work like everyone else. They visit, and my work has nothing to do with this. They came to my job site, and, you know, two agents burst in and pulled me into a conference room and demanded to know my source and, you know, threatened me. This is a federal investigation, and we'll get the U.S. attorney to get a subpoena. Well, that didn't work. Then they pulled my boss into the office and started, you know, harassing him, thinking, I think, that would get me fired. So it was clearly an intimidation matter. And then they left, you know, and that was it, you know. And so we filed a FOIA request, and it took us, you know, several years to get an answer. They had, you know, they kept denying it, one excuse after another. And finally they had to admit, well, yeah, we were wrong. There's some pages that could be released. And what it turned out is they had to launch an investigation because this Hispanic law enforcement organization filed a complaint on my behalf. And the way they handled that was the person that handled the investigation of it was essentially the same person that ordered the agents to my house. So it was pretty clear nothing was going to happen. It was just, you know, whitewashed. That's kind of how that works.
Yes. Again, not a particularly surprising aspect to that. I understand also that former Congresswoman Cynthia McKinney actually wrote a letter on your behalf regarding that case.
Yeah, she did. She wrote a letter to, you know, addressed it to Sutton, the Attorney General, and I think the head of Homeland Security at the time, and essentially establishing the facts of what happened, and, you know, including the intimidation by the ICE agents and calling them out on it, and, you know, demanding some explanation. But, I mean, and that was helpful. I mean, one of the things when all this is happening is it is helpful to have allies or a network. I mean, Narco News stood behind me. I mean, it definitely helps to have that. If you're out there on your own, you're a lot more vulnerable, not only to your own paranoia, but also just to the fact that you're easy to mess with if they think you're the only one they have to mess with. It's a lot harder when it's you know, all over the internet and there's, you know, hundreds of people, maybe more, thousands of people that know about it. In fact, Narco News wrote a story the day that the agents came to my house, and they included the phone numbers of the ICE agents in the story. And I was told later that that those phone numbers got so many calls that the agents had to get rid of the phones because they couldn't use them anymore.
Well, that is a great and story of how we can stick together in times like this, and hopefully some of the alternative media will be able to take lessons from that, because again, it really is important that that we do stand up to that type of intimidation, and to not allow the First Amendment rights to freedom of the press to be infringed. So again, there's just so much to go over in a story like this. And again, you have literally filed dozens and dozens of stories on this. So I will once again refer people to narconews.com/houseofdeath for more on the details and the ins and outs. But on the in the big picture, in the big scheme of things, what are some of the takeaways? What have we learned from this story? And what can we apply of that to what's going on in Mexico today?
Well, I think the one thing, at least that I learned from this story, that this happened in 2003, 2004, before the big ramp up in murders, that which really started about 2008, 2009, and really is continuing to this day. And what you can see, or at least what I can see, is that all the precursors were there for the drug war to just bleed out of control. And from the corruption on our side to the corruption on the Mexican side to the basically impunity with which people are allowed to operate when it involves profits and money. So you really aren't going to stop the drug war by pouring more money into guns and military and so forth. It's just it was predictable that it was just going to make it worse. You know, it goes back to kind of examining the underpinnings of what the problem is. And the problem is, you know, you can't prohibit something and not make it more valuable. And you can't expect to send a lot of firepower in support of prohibiting something without the firepower itself becoming a commodity, and eventually the lives involved becoming commodities. And, you know, That's a clear trajectory from, you know, what people might think was a relatively calm period in the drug war in 2003, 2004, where the bodies were buried in the backyard to the point where they were shot in the front yard. It isn't a long distance. And that's a cautionary tale for all of us. We could have done something sooner to prevent this from escalating, but we didn't choose to take action, I guess, either as a country or, you know, as a people, whatever. We were content to, you know, leave the dead buried in someone else's backyard.
It's a good point. The corruption doesn't go away. It just tends to rot and fester. And absolutely, it has to be rooted out when it's found. So once again, my hat's off to you for being so diligent on this case, and to people like Sandalgo Gonzalez for standing up for people on this issue and trying to get to the bottom of it. All right, well, I think we'll have to leave it there for now, but Bill Conroy, again, always fascinating conversation. So once again, I'll direct people to narconews.com for more of your research and analysis on all things related to the narcosphere, and we'll leave it there for now. So Bill Conroy, thank you again for your time today.
Yeah, good talking to you. Take care.